Support for the Legislative Gazette comes from New York State United Teachers, working to support students, educators, and public schools as the center of their communities through the Public Schools Unite Us initiative, and United University Professions, representing 37,000 academic and professional employees at SUNY campuses and teaching hospitals across New York State. Frederick E. Cole, President, UUPinfo.org. Governor Kathy Hochul approved amendments to the Adirondack State Land Master Plan this week. Regional advocates are applauding the provisions that will enhance access to the park's public lands by those with disabilities. More now from the Legislative Gazette's Pat Bradley.
The Adirondack State Land Master Plan is the guiding document for management of 2.9 million acres of public lands within the 6 million acre park. In September, the Adirondack Park Agency approved and forwarded the proposal to the governor for final approval. Regional advocates are supportive of provisions to increase access to state lands for those with disabilities. Adirondack Council spokesman John Sheehan says the amendments will move the conversation about power-driven mobility devices for the disabled to a statewide forum.
The Department of Environmental Conservation manages access to public lands across the state, and having one policy inside the Adirondack Park and a separate one in the rest of the state didn't seem to make a lot of sense. We're pleased to see that that's been transferred over to DEC.
Sheehan says that the amendment avoids the potential for damage to the forest preserve as a result of the use of motorized vehicles by the disabled.
By moving that to a statewide process that involves all public lands and not singling out wilderness areas as places that might need motorized access, which is, of course, destructive of the very idea of wilderness, I think we're on the right track now.
The amendments do not define so-called other powered mobility devices, or OPDMD, for people with disabilities. They are defined under the ADA as, quote, any mobility device powered by batteries, fuel, or other engines that is used by individuals with mobility disabilities for the purpose of locomotion, unquote. The devices include electric wheelchairs, electric scooters, golf carts, and segways. Accessible Adirondack Tourism founder Nick Friedman notes there has been an ongoing effort by the Adirondack Park Agency and Department of Environmental Conservation to define the devices and their impact on natural areas.
How do we reconcile our obligations legally to comply with the ADA, our moral obligations to provide people with disabilities access to the very spaces that those without a disability can access, because access means equality. And then you wind that in to our naturalist perspective and our fierce desire to protect our beautiful Adirondack Wonderland. It is complicated. And all of these moral, legal, and emotional ties are really what we're trying to balance.
Adirondack Park Local Government Review Board Executive Director Gerald Delaney hopes the amendments will make the Adirondacks more accessible to people with disabilities.
I really feel that the disabled have been ignored, and this is everybody's park.
The master plan amendments will also address another serious issue in the park, beaver ponds. Delaney said the DEC will drain beaver ponds to prevent flooding and damage to hiking trails.
Nobody traps anymore. We are into an era where more and bigger beaver dams, and that's going to create more loss of infrastructure. It is going to allow DEC to better manage the forest preserve. We'll see how it works out in practice, but I think this gives DEC those tools.
Sheehan, however, feels that the beaver habitat should be left alone.
Frankly, we'd prefer that they leave the beavers alone in wilderness areas. And if a trail gets flooded, well, let's build a new one around it then. But ultimately, we would like to see those things modified in future plans. But this is a plan that we can live with at the moment.
The master plan was also amended to eliminate deadlines for the Department of Environmental Conservation to remove abandoned or out-of-compliance structures in the forest preserve.
For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Pat Bradley.
listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government politics. I'm David Giustina. This week, I sat down with Blair Horner, Senior Policy Advisor for NYPIRG, the New York Public Interest Research Group, to talk about the state's bottle bill and why his good government group thinks it needs to be expanded.
Well, the companies that are covered under the bottle law hate it. And now we're talking about the law that's on the books since 1982 in New York that says that if you purchase certain types of beverages that are carbonated, beer and soda, or water bottles, you pay a nickel deposit. And when you bring the container back, when you're done, you get your nickel back. And the theory behind that, of course, is it removes from the waste stream containers that ordinarily would have to be, you know, dumped in a landfill or burned in an incinerator. And so that helps in terms of taxpayer costs as well as the environment. And it also brings back to the companies relatively clean product that can be recycled. And it's the most successful recycling program in New York. Now, the law has been on the books, as I mentioned, for decades plus, and it hasn't really gotten a modernization. So to your question about making it easier for people to use it, I mean, one of the things they could do under New York state law, everywhere where they sell one of these containers is supposed to be a sign at the checkout saying you can bring it back. Many people don't know that you can bring it back to the retailers that sell it. And they think the only places they can do that is maybe a supermarket or a big box store or a redemption center. And, you know, people may not feel like, you know, it's not worth it for the three sodas they buy in a month to return it when they go back to the same place where they bought the soda in the first place. They could just bring it back. So that's a very simple thing. The state could enforce its own law and make retailers do it. We were involved in a survey where we found that 80% of the retailers that we looked at, about 300 statewide, 80% of them didn't have the sign, at least we couldn't find one, and that of the remaining 20%, half had the sign in the wrong place, and the other half did have the sign. So roughly 90% were not complying with state law. And so that's something that the state could do that would make it a lot easier.
Well, Blair, I've got one other thing here that came to me as a result of speaking with the executive editor of the Berkshire Eagle about a story there that has to do with what I think a lot of people see, especially in inner cities and city areas, nip bottles, these small bottles of alcohol that people can put in their shirt or their jacket pocket and take a nip from. Well, they're having the same issue there, and I guess it's the same here, is that the bottle bill doesn't include these nip bottles. And so this nonprofit was offering a nickel for everybody who turned in a nip bottle. Something like, you know, 16,000 in the first week or something like that. So, wow. You know, you have these loopholes in the law, Blair. You know, where are nip bottles in New York State?
Yeah, I mean, you're right. New York State, again, only covers carbonated beverages and water beverages. They do not cover non-carbonated soft drinks like iced teas or sports drinks, not covered under the law. And that's mainly because they didn't exist in 1982. And it doesn't cover alcohol outside of beer. And so nip bottles are often used as small alcohol containers, and so they're just not covered. Now, there is legislation to fix that. And we've been urging the governor's office to embrace that because their own DEC has said that the law needs to be modernized, and you can do. And the state's landfills are filling up, and the permits are running out. So it's like, why not do the obvious thing to help? It won't knock out all of the solid waste in the state. We all have lots of paper packages and lots of plastic that we use, all that stuff, and foods, you know, food products, waste products. It all still has to be disposed of. But this is a law that's already on the books, and all it takes is a tweak to make it work better, and you would deal with the nips.
Well, from the nips to independent voters, we're talking with Blair Horner of the New York Public Interest Research Group, and independent voters are up in enrollment, and in fact, unaffiliated voters in New York outnumber Republicans. I spoke with Steven Greenberg from Siena Poll last week, and obviously the New York City election, Soran Mamdani, the coming gubernatorial election, which now features Elise Stefanik, among others, on the Republican side, running against Governor Hochul. But
perhaps the biggest thing is voting and voter rolls. This is what the politicians are looking at and making their strategies, and the independents top.
Yeah, I mean, there's been a real change. It's been basically a sea change in what voter enrollments look like in New York over the past 20 years. There's been a dramatic shift, and it's really, as far as I can, I mean, you know, the number of Democrats that are enrolled has went up, and then it's been stagnant now for a few years. In recent years, Republicans have been more or less stagnant, and a little bump up recently. But it's really the growth in voting voters are the unaffiliated voters, and they now, as you mentioned, there are more of them than there are Republicans. And yet, the way the system is set up under the state constitution is the two major political parties run the elections. Now, that was put in the 1970s as a way to sort of reform the way elections were run in New York, because you had to have the two parties agree. Nowadays, it often leads to gridlock. And what about all the other voters that are not in either one of the political parties? It's their elections, too. They have not a word. So the system definitely needs to be fixed in a way that would allow for the unaffiliated voices to be heard.
That's Blair Horner, senior advisor at NYPIRG, the New York Public Interest Research Group. You are listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina. As municipalities, water authorities, and homeowners are grappling with ridding infrastructure of the health risk that lead water service lines can pose, there are still two major obstacles: logistics and money. Ryan Zunner of the New York Public News Network reports on the work being done, including a new data tool, and what still lies ahead before a nationwide 2037 lead-free rule.
The New York League of Conservation Voters has just released an interactive map outlining the entirety of the state's water service lines and whether they're made of non-lead, lead, or possible lead materials. It's a compilation of data collected by a plethora of government agencies, serving as a one-stop shop no matter where you live. Its revelations are stark. Around 3.1 million people in New York receive their drinking water through confirmed or suspected lead pipes. That's 15% of the state's population. Buffalo has the highest confirmed percentage for major cities outside of New York City at 45%.
What's equally heartbreaking is that there's an equal amount, another 45%, where it's unknown. And there's going to be a good portion of those that will be discovered.
That's Joshua Kleinberg, senior vice president of the New York League of Conservation Voters. He says while Buffalo's data certainly leads the pack, lead pipes and their associated health hazards hit communities large and small, rural and urban, wealthy and impoverished. Federal rules require replacement work to begin in 2027 and finish by the end of 2037. Many towns and cities have already started, and while New York has set up a grant program, there's currently no state guidelines for when or what they're replaced with or who foots the bill. Kleinberg says that needs to change.
You have some communities that are working with homeowners to share the cost and others that are just giving the entire bill to the homeowners, sticking them with it. You have some communities that are using plastic piping, other that are using copper. You have all these different modes and methods for doing this.
The advocacy for more state support is echoed by Jerome Shad, chairman of the Erie County Water Authority. Their district does not include the city of Buffalo, but many neighboring and outlying communities. He says about 90% of their requests are denied.
Criteria itself is very fair in terms of equities of who's the poorest community, who's the neediest. But we happen to be a large system, and we have a number of affluent neighborhoods, and we have a number of very unaffluent neighborhoods. But we're measured by the totality, and so we often do not get approved because we don't hit the mean level of need.
In 1981, a few years before lead pipes were officially banned in the U.S., the federal government allocated $25 billion towards water infrastructure, almost half of total investment in the area. By 2021, that amount had dwindled down to $4 billion. The Infrastructure Improvement and Jobs Act passed the same year, putting that number up to $55 billion, but Kleinberg says that money is slated to run out by the end of next year.
As the federal money winds down over the next year and a half, and as we get to that two-year point where the 10-year starting gun fires, this is really a wake-up call now to have the policies and the public financing in place. So this is a seamless transition, and we can remove all lead pipes quickly, cost efficiently, and also importantly, very equitably.
Right now for Erie County water customers, the authority's chairman says their cost of replacement is being carried mostly by them.
We are optimistic that we're going to succeed on getting all the lead out, and we're going to keep asking every year to get financial support from the state to help us.
If you believe your home has lead pipes, you can call your local water authority. And Kleinberg says doing things like running your water after long periods of non-use, only using cold water to cook, and buying a lead-certified filtration cartridge can help. In Buffalo, Ryan Zunner for the New York Public News Network.
You are listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina.
Welcome back to the Legislative Gazette. I'm David Gustina. Well, a special guest with us this week on the program, it's Emily Kenney. She is a Spectrum News New York reporter. Welcome to the Legislative Gazette, Emily.
Thank you, David.
Well, interesting. You folks are working on programs that are set up to help the homeless in Western and Central New York and the state legislation that's supposed to assist them. Maybe we should start there, Emily, with what is the state legislation that's supposed to assist folks who are homeless?
Sure. So one of the programs that we were looking at was the Temporary Assistance Program. Under that umbrella, there's a lot of other programs. There's temporary assistance for needy families. There's other forms of payment that the state gives out to people experiencing homelessness. And kind of what we were looking at was how it's decided in each county the standard of need based on household size, you know, the number of kids, any income they earn. But there haven't been any adjustments to those standard of need allotments. So for Onondaga County, for example, a family of four receives $842 a month, and the average apartment that would cost, or the fair market rate for an apartment here for a family of four is about $1,800 a month.
Yeah, so this problem with homelessness is growing. Am I correct about that?
Yes, yep.
Then where do you house a lot of folks? And with a housing crisis that we're hearing about, not only in New York, but all around the region. So then we enter with, what, hotels?
Yep. What we found was that most of the family shelters have been full since 2021, 22, depending on which county you're looking at. And so when they have this surplus of specifically families, but individuals as well, but the families, they have a harder time placing because they need more rooms or more beds. There's certain requirements from the state. And if you have a certain number of kids, you have to have a certain number of beds and a private bathroom. So, yeah, the counties have been having to put people in hotels and motels. In Erie County, for example, they spent $13.1 million putting people up in hotels. In 2024, and then in Onondaga County, it was $3.4 million in 2024, which is an increase by millions of dollars.
We're speaking with Emily Kenney. She is a reporter for Spectrum News New York. You know, one of the things that we hear about, especially in the larger cities like New York City, is that many of the folks who are homeless don't want to go to homeless shelters because they fear for their safety, because the conditions are squalid or unkempt. And I'm wondering if that's part of what some experience in Central and Western New York, where they're concerned about the quality of the place they'll be put.
Yeah, I think that's definitely a concern. The family shelter here I visited as part of this reporting, and it was in good shape. You know, it was about what you would expect. But I think the hotels where they have been aren't being held to the same standard. I met with a woman who'd been living at out of a hotel here in Syracuse with her son for about 6 months, and she had documented records of mice. She showed me photos of the microwave and the fridge and things, and they were just really not in good shape. And she also showed me some of the electrical outlets and lights weren't working. But when I reviewed the inspection report from Onondaga County that was done in August, none of those things were documented. So I think the difficulty is that they want them to have a roof over their head, and being in a hotel is certainly better than being on the street. But they're paying these hotels a lot of money. This specific hotel was $850,000 last year, and they don't have any rooms open to the public. So the only thing they're doing is housing these families, which means they don't necessarily have to have the same staffing they would if they were open to people purchasing rooms. They may not have to hold them to the same standard because they know that the county's going to pay them for these rooms.
You know, one of the other aspects of this is that folks who end up homeless for a number of reasons, and I'd like to point out that any one of us could end up in that situation if there was a severe illness, loss of income, drug addiction, something like that. But that's the other part of this, isn't it, Emily, that there are a number of people who are out in the streets that are suffering from other problems, including mental illness. So I wonder, when you speak to the people who run the shelters, who are trying to help these folks, what they're telling you, what they need most.
Yeah, they definitely are advocating for more affordable housing, which I know the county and the state have a lot of initiatives for that, but it doesn't get built overnight. And I know some of the concerns around the temporary assistance, Deputy Director of Human Services in Syracuse would like to see those rates changed because that would help alleviate some of that gap in funding for them. And 10 years ago when the rates were set, things are obviously a lot different now in price. And the other thing is that they always want to see more support for mental health issues and even drug addiction, any kind of thing that could tie back to mental health. They do have a number of outreach programs here in Syracuse, and I know in Buffalo, to help these people. And one of the shelters we talked to in Buffalo, their main goal is to really get people out of the cycle of homelessness. And so they try to offer ongoing assistance for those people. And the other thing with the SNAP benefits, these people in hotels, there's no kitchen. So they have a microwave and they have a small fridge. And in Syracuse, there is a nonprofit called Catholic Charities that goes around and delivers food, which is great. And it's freshly made food. They do a really nice job preparing the meals and packing them individually for each family member. But that's not the case in every other county. So they're having to use their SNAP benefits or other food assistance to cover those costs. But the microwave meals are convenient, but not always the best thing for everyone, and they are a little more expensive. So that was certainly a challenging time for those people when they were out their benefits.
We're speaking with Emily Kenny, Spectrum News New York reporter. Emily, you hear about the numbers going up when it comes to people who are experiencing food insecurity and homelessness, other problems, but I wonder, because it's often nameless and faceless when we talk about it, if you could put a face on this for us. Could you tell us about a person or a family, their circumstances, maybe how they got there and how they're being helped?
So the woman that I worked with most closely in this story, her name is Alicia Burkhart. She was originally from New York, then moved to Georgia for about 20 years, and she moved back here 2 years ago. And she has a 3-year-old son named Kingston. And they were living out of the budget when they were not able to find an affordable place to live when they moved back here. And so they've been living out of the budget for about 6 months. And the challenge for her, she was receiving assistance, and then she felt like that wasn't enough. So then she got a job part-time, like 15, 20 hours a week, making minimum wage at a a Family Dollar, Dollar Tree here in Syracuse. And then she was told she was making too much to receive the same amount of assistance that she was. So she ended up quitting that job because she couldn't make ends meet with the job and assistance. So she had to, you know, pick one or the other. And she also has to care for her child. So she had to, he goes to daycare, which costs money. And so now she actually was able to get a permanent place with some of the assistance from the Department of Social Services. And she and Kingston have their own permanent place now. And they were telling me that, she was telling me that this week she got her furniture voucher, so she'll be able to get more permanent furniture for him. And he really likes the show Bluey, so he's going to get a Bluey bed set.
That's Spectrum News New York reporter Emily Kenney. And that about does it for this week's show. The Legislative Gazette is a production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio. We had help from the New York Public News Network. You can listen anytime at WAMCpodcast.org or anywhere you get your podcasts. Look for program number 2548. And join us again next week at this same time for more news on New York State government and politics. For the Legislative Gazette, I'm David Gustina.
Support for the Legislative Gazette comes from United University Professions, representing 37,000 academic and professional employees at SUNY campuses and teaching hospitals across New York State. Frederick E. Cole, President, UUPinfo.org.